This is the best of a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Hank.
What's on your mind today?
Well, you and I actually seem to always be in the seats together when we have heavier topics. Have you ever noticed that?
Lucky me.
But I'm glad that you're here today. I appreciate when you're sitting in, so thank you for going along for the ride. What's on my mind today is I noticed there's been a theme to the shows. There's always a theme of mental health, but there's been a heaviness to the shows with a lot of references to grieving and loss and transitions and grief and loss. Like, almost every story for the last few weeks has had pieces of that. And when I was thinking about, you know, kind of looking at the shows moving forth, like, why am I in this space? Am I, you know, clearly going through some grieving loss myself? And so usually the show goes where my heart is going, and I must be in kind of that heavy place. The recognition that something has changed finitely and we're not going back. Because at the beginning, there's just the shock that this loss has happened. And again, you're just getting through. But after the shock wears off, there is the grief and the acceptance and the anger and the denial and the depression, all of those steps of grieving before we can actually emerge again in a new way. So that's what's on my mind today. And fortunately, I made contact with an author who just so happened to have written a book about her own experience with grief and loss and tragedy. And this book is not only her story, but it also offers really practical, accurate, important conversations about how the grieving process works and things you can actually do to help move yourself through the grief and loss. Because anytime we suffer a death or a loss, there's a million things that go on for us, but one of the most consistent things is that we don't know who we will be on the other side. And that not knowing who we will be on the other side can be really disorienting. So to have this book as a guide or a reference to help people not feel so alone with their loss and grief, I think is really important. So I've invited Claire Agard on the show, and her book is called When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. And Claire tells this story through her own lens of losing her son. So I've invited Claire to talk about the book, but also her experience of over 20 years working as a certified grief counselor and working with families and helping to shepherd them through their own experience. You can also follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Just look for The Reluctant Therapist. You can leave me a message there. After the show, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can follow us through podcasts. Just go wherever you find your podcast, look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, subscribe, leave a review, and you can listen at your convenience and other people can find us. And as always, you can listen to all 10 years of our previous shows. Well, Hank's shaking his head. We don't have all 10 years, but almost all the 10 years are still available if you go to kcbx.org and search through A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're going to take a quick break and catch our breath and come back and start our conversation with Claire Agard. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This is the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Time to laugh, a time.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Welcome to my guest, Claire Agard. Thank you for coming in today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote your book, When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. From your perspective of a grieving parent, but also after or through 20 years of going through your own healing and then using that as a grief counselor to help other families deal with their loss. And it's a beautifully written book, and I love the practicality of all of the chapters. Of you could just open it and read a chapter to help you think about your faith and spirituality when you move through this, or how the circumstances of the death or loss impact you. And just for parents or anyone surviving the loss of a child, to know that you're not alone in the feelings and experiences. And I wanted to read I love the quote on the back of the book that you wrote, because I think it sets us up well. You wrote, "It will not always hurt as much as it does right now. Go slowly, be gentle and forgiving, and choose your path forward with loving intention." It probably took you a few years to get to that place to be able to write something like this.
It took me a lot of years, yes. And I imagine most grieving parents, when the loss comes, especially if it's sudden and unexpected, you're just shattered. The foundation on which you stand is just crumbled underneath you, and so you're sort of thrust into this place of emotional chaos. And so when I went to retire, I had a difficult time leaving the work, as hard as it was. It's beautiful work, it's inspiring work, it's humbling work, and I always felt as if I were honoring my son Eric with every parent that I sat with. And so when I went to write the book, I wanted to leave something that I could essentially have handed to a newly grieving parent. And so when I started to sit down and write it, it was very important to me that I not make it complicated, that I not speak in counselor terms or therapist terms, that it be a guide that any parent could pick up and look at and be able to read. Most grieving parents will tell you they have a hard time looking at a newspaper or
focusing on anything.
So I wanted it to be simple and straightforward, and I kept in the back of my mind the whole time, who are you writing this to? And that helped tremendously.
So Claire, what was the story that inspired you going into this work and writing this book?
Well, I was a young mom. I had just turned 30 years old. I had two beautiful little boys. Eric was almost two and Christian was 4.5. And I started my morning, as I did many mornings, by going to my sister's horse ranch a couple of miles away and going for a run, and she would watch the boys, and then I'd go on with my day and she would go on with hers. And this particular day, as we were preparing to leave, the children went outside and I realized Eric didn't have his jacket, so I went back in to get it, and my sister followed me because I couldn't find it. And when we came out, we couldn't find any of the children. So we assumed little Eric was with my other son, and with my sister's two older children who were still at home, because it was early in the morning. And so when we found them and not Eric, we immediately started that search that just absolutely panics every parent. They did have a backyard pool that had a cover on it, one of those detachable covers that has since been outlawed. And we quickly looked under the cover, didn't see him, and then we were panicked because we're on a horse farm. He could have slipped into a paddock or any number of things. Long story short, he was found about 20 minutes after we had realized he was gone, and he had been in the pool, and he was unresponsive, taken to Twin Cities, flown to Stanford, and it was always a very grim prognosis. He was not responsive at all, and he was put into an induced coma, and it's It's hard to go back and remember that time.
Your eyes well up. I'm sure the story does get easier.
It's hard. We were so scared. We felt like we were so far away. We didn't have cell phones. This is pre-cell phone age. So we didn't have our people with us. We didn't have anyone we could sort of gather. And so Eric was in a coma, a chemically induced coma, for about a week or two. And then when they pulled him out of that, there really wasn't a change. And that was pretty dire. He did not have a gag reflex. He was really in a vegetative state. So they sent him across the street to Children's Hospital, where he stayed for about another 3 or 4 weeks, with the hope that with some real good input and rehab, he might start to improve. And he didn't. And during this period of time, you know, once they get to that place, then they're no longer appropriate for a hospital.
Right.
So they were talking about, and I use this word in the book, facilities, and just the idea of putting my precious 2-year-old in a facility, I couldn't bear it. But he was really too sick to bring home. He was having a difficult time keeping any food in him. And during our stay at Stanford, Shawnee DeGroot, who had been operating a home for children with severe disabilities, she had contacted us because she'd seen an article in the paper and said, I hope it all goes well, but if it doesn't, I would be willing to take Eric. And so we contacted her, and she took him into her beautiful home and really cared for him like she did all of her children there, like he was hers. Mm-hmm. She embraced our family. I was able to see him every day. I took Christian, our son, with us most of the time. Jim was trying to get back to work, so he came some of the time as well. And he stayed there for 8 months. He was up at Stanford 2 months, stayed there 8 months, and then he finally passed away at Shawnee's.
It doesn't get any easier over the 8 or 9 months, does it?
It honestly, Elizabeth, felt like torture because our pediatrician, Dr. Tidone, who we adored.
I think the entire community.
I had worked for him briefly, and he literally shut his practice down the day the accident happened and came to the emergency room. It was such a comfort. But he said, you know, he could go tomorrow. He could last for several years. You need to try to establish a normal life again. Well, we didn't know what that meant. How could it be normal when we're watching our son basically slowly die. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very difficult time. During that time, I found out I was pregnant with our daughter. And so I was very worried about harming this beautiful new life inside of us while watching another one ebb away.
It's honestly, it did.
It felt like torture. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when Eric finally did die, I had a few people say, oh, what a relief that must have been. Well, it did not feel like a relief, you know.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Baird, and my guest today is Claire Agard. And we're talking about her beautifully written book, When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. And we're starting with Claire's story of loss and grief. And so I would imagine that after Eric died, you go through the shock and you give birth, then the grief starts. I mean, because I understand that grief is a delayed experience.
Sure. And I was so paralyzed and immobilized by my grief and my feelings of guilt around his death that I really just sort of switched into sort of an automated place. I was thrilled with the birth of our baby daughter. I took care of that was really my saving grace, was having to get up every day and take care of two little ones that needed their mom.
You just focus in that space.
But after a year or two of that, I realized that I wasn't my best self, that I needed to really address the grief that it was really crushing.
And I don't think people recognize that, though. I don't even know in our culture if we talk about it. People assume that as soon as the death happens, grief happens. But there's really the shock, as you experience.
Absolutely.
And then the grief doesn't come until we start to awaken again to having to stay alive.
And are maybe brave enough or have the resources mm-hmm. or the support to do your grieving. That is hard work.
So where did you turn? Because you didn't exist for yourself.
Right. I really stumbled along for quite some time. After a couple of years, I recognized that I really did need to address my grief. And just knowing that I did and recognizing and feeling some compassion for myself was a turning point for me. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it wasn't until I became connected with hospice about 7 years later that all of a sudden I was invited to tell the story, which most of my people near to me didn't want me to tell because they knew it was so painful and they felt as if they were protecting me by not having me tell the story. So in this new environment of support and these wonderful therapists and caring folks really encouraged me to tell my story. And then I was connected with a psychologist who made all the difference in the world for me. And once I was able to address my grief and start to resolve some of my grief, then I was able to move forward and actually start to think about helping others who might be in this position.
I would imagine also, and I'm curious to know when the heaviness, the guilt and shame and grief lifted a bit and you realized, oh, I want to be here with these kids and I want to have this life. How long did it take you to get to that?
Well, I think, like I said, when a couple of years after the death, I told my husband I need to go away for a couple of days, and my husband is absolutely so wonderful and supportive, and he knew I was struggling, and so he said, absolutely, do what you need to do, and it was at the beach in Cambria that I found a place of compassion for myself and knew that that was the task ahead of me, mm-hmm. but it really wasn't until I met with Dr. Jeff Friedman, who's a psychologist here in San Luis, who helped me with the guilt. He was willing to go there. Mm-hmm. He was willing to pull that apart and encouraged me to feel that. And that was huge for me. And he introduced, and I bring it out in the book, this idea of partial forgiveness for yourself, mm-hmm. Working towards understanding because something bad happened, it didn't make me a bad person, that there's a difference. Mm-hmm. And that may seem really simple, but it's really not. It's sort of you when you're really overwhelmed with those feelings of guilt and shame that gets attached to that, then you feel as if you're such a terrible person. And that, of course, then just compounds everything. And what I discovered in working with grieving parents is that so many parents, no matter what the circumstance, have a diminishment of self-esteem. Because we're supposed to make sure, yes, our children are okay. So when our children die, especially at a young age, there's an overwhelming sense of failure. Mm-hmm. So that diminished self-esteem, that's a lens through which you're looking, that is really going to color your parenting, your interactions with your family, your friends, your spouse, absolutely.
Because yeah. Not many couples make it through the death of a child, do they?
It can be challenging. What I would tell my parents that I was working with is that this is probably the biggest stress that you will encounter. And if there are cracks in your relationship, they're going to get pulled wide open. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean they can't be repaired, but you are going to really find your relationship is challenged. And communicating where you are with your grief and how you can support one another is really key.
And then kind of going back to the guilt piece, because I think people never want us to feel badly. So friends aren't right. going to ask you about it or address mm-hmm. that you might feel guilty. And I imagine part of you is thinking, everyone should be blaming me and yelling at me. Right?
I know.
Why aren't you yelling at me?
Yes.
Because I need to have some sort of exoneration or right penance mm-hmm. that I pay.
I think of, and I do. I think I mentioned this in the book, but my husband and I went out to dinner about 10 years after the loss. And I said to him, why haven't you blamed me? Why aren't you angry with me? And he was just dumbfounded at the question, which tells you a lot about him. But he said, I felt guilty. And I said, how could you feel guilty? You weren't even there that day. And he said, I'm the dad. You know, I felt as if my love for my family should be enough to protect you. So mm-hmm. I felt like I'd failed. Wow. that, you know, sort of gave me that realization I did not have a corner on guilt. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, no matter what I did, he wasn't going to turn on me. And I would have been happy if he had. I mean, I say that I wouldn't have been happy, but I expected it.
You wouldn't have been surprised. Yeah. And I think that's so important, because in counseling or just in grieving or healing, mm-hmm. that becomes the elephant in the room, I think.
Yes.
And that people start avoiding us because they don't know how to talk. What happened with your friend groups and your support system? Were they able to be there for you? Or did you feel like?
Some of them were, and I did have my family, and I did have some wonderful friends. But I remember this one friend who was beautiful and loving and kind and caring, taking me to breakfast, and I was telling her what a bad mom I felt that I was, and she insisted that I was a good mom, kept insisting I was a good mom until I kind of snapped at her and said, good moms don't let their kids drown. And I just remember, it looked like I'd slapped her. I felt so bad, but I just needed her to hear. And I came to realize that most grieving parents don't want to hear in the beginning what great parents they are.
Yes.
They don't feel like great parents.
Part of the healing is being able to sit with the guilt and the shame and have people recognize it, so that you can give it a place to live. Because
exactly.
I would imagine that becomes, in some ways, the most toxic part that eats at you, that secret guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm.
And that once someone witnesses that, like your psychologist, and you get to say, okay, I won't be 100% forgiven, but I can give myself a little bit of forgiveness.
Exactly.
And that must have been the starting point.
It was huge for me. It was huge. And then the work started around, how do I release 80% or 90%, and recognizing that in that moment on that day, I was not the parent I needed and should have been. Before that, I had been the parent that I wanted to be. And so he was really helpful in letting me see that all that happened before and all that was happening afterwards was about my intention to be a good parent. Mm-hmm. And that was just so helpful. And when I would work with parents who were feeling so guilty, there is this sort of feeling of wanting to rush in and save them and
yes.
tell them they're not guilty. And it was so important for me to allow them to really express that and to sit with it and let them tell me why they felt guilty. Mm-hmm. And often if you do that, the parent will eventually circle back to what their intent was mm-hmm. to always keep their kids safe.
But it is counterintuitive that we think we will avoid the really challenging part and just focus on what good people we are. And I think in some ways we unintentionally prevent people from healing because we don't allow them to deal with the ugly parts that they're feeling about themselves.
It's very hard to support a grieving parent who feels guilty, is angry. I always, when someone would call to ask, how can we be supportive? And I'm so worried I'm going to say the wrong thing. Really tried to validate that, first of all, your concern and your willingness to be there is huge, and that it is very difficult to sit in that amount of pain.
Mm-hmm. My guest today is Claire Agard, and we're talking about her book, When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. And we're not just talking about the book, but we're talking about the life that happens after the mm-hmm. loss of your child, because I'm curious to know how you parented your other two children. Did you wrap them in bubble wrap? You know,
I wish. I wanted to.
How did you find your footing to parent again?
I truly worked very, very hard not to make them neurotic, you know, and they'll have to answer how well I did. No, I'm proud to say I have two extraordinary human beings for my son and daughter. But I remember my husband, right after Eric's accident, sharing a story about a woman in his neighborhood whose son had died. And she became a recluse. She erected a shrine in their home. And he said, you aren't going to get weird like that, are you? I said, I hope not. But
no
guarantees.
Yeah.
I tried to be honest with my kids and let them know that my inclination was to be very, very protective, and that I really, in my heart, wanted them to have a normal childhood. I wanted them to have overnights, and I wanted them to play at swimming pools and and go to the beach with other people besides me. But it was hard. I let them do those things, and I felt like I could suffer in silence, yes. You know, but it was the most important that they get to do those things. But it was very difficult for me. And when they both became of driving age, I remember saying to them, you just have to communicate with me. You have to let me know. And if you're going to be late, let me know. And if you're not coming home, let me know, because I can go from 0 to 100 pretty quick. And I mean, I go to the dark place, you know, and I don't hear from you. I think you've had a car accident or... And I would tell my grieving parents, you know, it's like the barrier that is somewhat normal for most parents, so that, you know, when something, you're worried about something, you think, well, they're probably fine. Right. If you've lost a child, that's gone.
Right, because that bubble was popped.
That illusion is no longer. Mm-hmm. So you immediately go to the very worst case scenario. And it is important to try and manage that. It's hard. Mm-hmm. It's very hard. Yeah.
So how did this death impact Christian? I'm just curious how his trajectory was.
It actually impacted both my kids, to be honest, mm-hmm. which is interesting, because Maggie was born 3 months after mm-hmm. Eric died. For Christian, I didn't really realize how much it had affected him, because, again, as I was asking, I was worried. Everyone was saying, he'll be fine. He'll be fine. And he is fine, but he would have benefited from my counterpart that I worked with, Diane Thompson, who worked with the kids. I typically worked with the parents, and she took the kids. And, you know, if someone could have let him tell the story himself and maybe make a memory box and be able to sort of guide him through that process. What he did is he tried to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until he handed me his high school essay to proof, and I realized he wanted me to read, that he had spent his childhood thinking that if he were perfect, it would ease our pain. He knew that we were grieving parents. And to be honest, my daughter sort of picked up on that too. And she was told from the very beginning, oh, you've saved your mother.
That's a lot of pressure.
Exactly. Exactly. And so she began to feel as if her job was to protect me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, both things I wish I had known a little earlier to ease for them. And so working with grieving parents, that was something I could talk about early on. You know, make sure that they know you're okay, that yeah. you're going to be okay, that you're getting the help you need, and they don't need to be anything other than children. They don't need to take care of you.
We've come a long way in our understanding of grief in the last 20 plus years.
Yes, we have.
In huge strides. My guest today is Claire Agard. We're here talking about her book and her life experience that drove her to writing a book on grief and loss and surviving the loss of a child. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country, come take me home again.
You're listening to the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on KCBX.
And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. Get peace train, holy roller.
Everyone jump up on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. Come on. Good friends too, 'cause it's getting nearer,
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And the book that we're talking about today is called When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. My guest is Claire Agard. And our number is 805-781-3875 if you have a question or comment. So how did you decide, or what led you into doing the training to become a grief counselor? Because, I mean, it makes sense that it would be a way to process, but I don't think every grieving parent chooses to devote their life to this. So why this path?
About 7 years after Eric's death, I saw that San Luis Hospice of San Luis County, I want to get that right, was offering a training for volunteers. They were trying to start a program about children's grief. And I thought, well, perhaps I can offer some insight, seeing my five-year-old lost his brother. And so I started there, and they quickly asked me to join the staff, and I was actually working in the volunteer program. And it started my journey, as I mentioned before, towards my own healing and grief work around my son's death. And I just found myself, really drawn towards the bereavement end of things. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Doug Bing, who was there at Hospice of SLO for a long time, and Dr. Anita Kowalski. And I started finding myself moving towards that. And honestly, there was one case that really solidified it for me. And I had told my hospice nurses, if you encounter someone who has if we have a child on service, which didn't happen, thankfully, very often, it's okay for you to let them know there's a staff person who's had the death of a child. And I was working in the bereavement program at that time. I went out to this home of a little girl who was dying of a brain tumor. She was about 8 years old. Her name was Elena. And I sat with the parents, and they asked me a lot of questions, and I always started with, you can ask me anything. If I'm not comfortable answering, I'll let you know. And when I went to leave, the dad walked me out and he said, thank you for coming today. I was really nervous about you being here. And inside I'm thinking, you were nervous. I was really nervous. I said, why were you nervous? And he said, because I knew when I saw you, because you'd lost a child, that I would see pain. I would know that this is how I'm going to look and feel for the rest of my life. And I didn't see that. You radiated joy and warmth, and you were able to sit and talk about this, and it gives me great hope. And then as we were walking out his little gate, he said, and thank you for bringing Eric with you today. And wow, I thought, first of all, how powerful is it mm-hmm. that by my opening up about having lost a child, it opened a space that perhaps wouldn't have been opened, that they felt comfortable in, because I was one of them. Mm-hmm. And then the other idea of bringing Eric with me was like, well, that's pretty cool too. So I always thought of him kind of sitting on my shoulder, and my staff used to always tease me that I kept that little boy very busy.
Yeah. And when you work with families, what is your first thought? I'm just curious, are you trying to shore up the couple relationships so they can support each other? Are you trying to support the individual? What's your first move into helping parents?
You know, really, it's about just being there with them, sharing that while I don't know what it feels like to lose their child, I have experienced the loss of a child. And really just sitting in that space and letting them know that I'm there, I'm going to be there for them, they can get through this. And it's almost normalizing, sounds like such a trite word, but it's really normalizing the enormity of what they're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And that phrase, it won't always hurt as much as it does now, I often would say that to my parents, and after several weeks or months, and I would work with people for a long time, they would share with me, I needed to hear that every single time, because it didn't ever feel as if it could ever be anything other than soul crushing.
In some ways, you almost are a beacon or the lighthouse mm-hmm. out there in the distance. Mm-hmm. People are mm-hmm. struggling through the rapid.
Yeah, and you don't like to use the word hope too much because in the beginning that feel they don't even want to hope for what. You know, I just want my child back. But when it felt appropriate, I would tell them that I recognized that they didn't have that hope for themselves, but that I could hold it for them, that I could harbor that for them. And that was also something they told me later was real important to hear, that somebody believed that they could get through this, someone that had credibility with them, that they could get through this.
That's a beautiful gift to be able to share.
Oh, it's huge.
Ross, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Can I just ask what year this happened in? What year are we talking about when Eric died?
His accident happened in November of 1983, and he died in September of 1984.
And did you say that he was treated at Children's Hospital at Stanford?
He was.
I worked there. I'm an RN, and I worked there.
Wow.
And then I went on to actually work for a hospice in San Jose, Hospice of the Valley, and I started their pediatric hospice program there.
Oh, so wow.
I'm just listening to you, and it's just bringing back a flood of memories of, you know, being a nurse up in that fabulous place and seeing children and working with parents. And I'm feeling like I want to volunteer now again at a hospice.
You'd be wonderful.
And so, Rosh, how did this work change you?
In some ways it prepared me for the loss of my husband, which, of course, is a different thing, which happened in 1993. I don't know, being with children and parents like that is so different than adult nursing. We would get very, very close to the parents and children. So we really shared grief whenever we lost a child. And it's different, you know, in adult nursing, you sort of tend to just, you know, stoically go on with the rest of your day. But in pediatrics, it's a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm. Something that you don't just leave behind when you go home each night.
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that the work that I've done in the past with hospice and with pediatrics just has stayed with me. I think it will just stay with me always. I mean, I've moved on. I've got a different life. I'm not doing any clinical nursing now, but it stays with me, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure that Claire would encourage you to keep finding your way back to the grief work.
I would. And if you were possibly someone who nurtured and cared for my son, thank you so much.
Yes, I was mostly at that time working on the Ross unit, which was the psychosomatic unit, but I was sometimes nursing supervisor, so I covered all the units. And sometimes I floated to the other unit. Was he on Babcock or...
I don't know.
You know what
I don't know.
Okay.
Somewhere close by, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And feeling the hearts. Rosh, thank you for calling and sharing your memories with us. I appreciate you.
Okay.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And so, Claire, for parents or people grieving who are listening, what are some things that they can put into... Besides catching your book and reading it, but what are some things that you feel were most helpful for you or in the book that you really want parents to know?
Well, I think it's important to share, find the people that can sit with you in this place. And there may not be very many who are able to truly hear the place of pain that you're in. But if you can gather even one or two people that can hear you. And that's where sometimes if you can find a grief counselor, where you can go to a safe space and really share exactly how you're feeling. Surround yourself with people who are able to support you wherever you are. And that's what's so difficult, because grief itself, and especially this type of intense grief, it's all over the place. You know, you may be having a good day and then be triggered. And there are so many triggers. And so it's important to be able to be gentle with yourself and forgiving of yourself as you walk through this. This is very hard work to do. And talk about it as much as you can.
And so when you work with families, and I would imagine that they're testing their faith and they're testing mm-hmm. their belief in themselves or each other, how do you, you know, how do parents, because I guess part of, I'm hearing you talk the story about space and sitting with someone, and I think that's the key to all things in life is mm-hmm. to be able to sit and just witness and hear someone, know that we don't have to fix them or right. answer right. their questions, but to really, people say, but there must be something more. It's like, no, it's just being willing, even in silence, to sit there. But when a family or a couple is challenging their faith and questioning, like, as a grief counselor, how do you sit with that? Because they're not going to sometimes be silent. It's like, yes, there's the mm-hmm, silent moments where we're just mm-hmm. going to cry. But I imagine the anger is there, too. Mm-hmm. And they're turning to you and saying, don't tell me.
Well, I wouldn't pretend to know the answers to those huge questions. Mm-hmm. Why did God let this happen?
Right.
If indeed that's how they're feeling. I asked all those questions as well. And so for me as a grief counselor, it would be enabling them and encouraging them to ask those big questions and know that, and I would certainly own, I don't have the answers to those. And exploring that with them, what does that mean for you? What was your faith system before this happened? How has that changed? Has it changed? For some people, it changed radically. For others, they would fall back into the faith system and find that to be a comfort. But for many, even if it was brief, there is a period of, I don't know what I believe in anymore. Mm-hmm. If this could happen, I just don't know. And yeah, those are hard questions. But
how did it shift for you?
I think I was brought up as a good little Catholic girl. And I really believed that if I was a, you know, good person and went to church and said my prayers, that I was protected. And it was a pretty simplistic view of a faith system. And what I recognized, I was really angry with God and myself. And you could argue I was angry with that place inside of me that where God resides. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has a different way of holding that. But I was just so angry. And when I was able to process that and work through that, it occurred to me that that isn't really how I believe faith works, that there isn't. I read a line in a book. It was when bad things happen to good people. And it talked about, you know, imagining that there's some entity that is so cruel mm-hmm. that this entity would say, well, there's a sweet little two-year-old, I'll have him fall in a pool. You know, it just didn't make sense to me. I didn't believe in a God like that. Mm-hmm. So that helped me to really understand that our faith is about having something that comforts us, something we can lean into, something that we can hold on to for me. Now, for everyone, that's completely different. But when I was able to eventually circle back to my faith, it had so much more meaning mm-hmm. because it wasn't about thinking that there was an ominous presence that, you know, was going to decide my fate. And honestly, some people truly believe that this is part of a plan. It just didn't make sense for me that mm-hmm. there was anyone who had a plan like that. But I respect and honor those that perhaps feel there is a reason. That was difficult to hear in the early stages of my grief, and most of my parents would agree with me if someone would say, well, it must have happened for a reason, or, you know, that God had a plan. That is often not a comforting thought for newly grieving
parents. As with most cliches, we should probably say.
Exactly.
Is it anything that comes on a card is not a good condolence?
Right. Right.
Even yeah. though it takes the pressure off because yeah. it's written on a card.
Yeah.
The cliches generally aren't helpful.
No. And
I remember when I had a cousin who was killed in a car accident, and the priest at the service just flat out said, some things are just accidents. They're not all God's will, and this was an accident. And that was such a powerful thing
exactly.
for him to say yeah. for my uncle and for the family.
Right.
I said, yes, it was an accident.
Right.
This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Bill, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Well, this may sound insensitive, but do you ever reassure people that have lost children that by letting them be children and letting them do dangerous things, that you're letting, you know, you're giving them a childhood? And if you try and take that away by being overprotective, they may act it out later and go into extreme sports and do reckless things because their mothers never let them do anything.
Sure, that was my fear. I hear you. Yes, and when a child has died, especially as a result of an accident, there's a knee-jerk reaction on the part of the parents to then be as protective as possible to prevent something else from happening. So, yes, the goal is to try and allow them in a safe way to just be kids.
Thanks for calling, Bill. And, you know, we talk a lot about the moving forward and moving on. And I started the show talking about just kind of the place that we're all at universally, years that have shifted everything in everyone's lives. And part of the conversation moving forward is, who are we now because we can't go back? And I think that's a big part of the grieving process, is accepting that we are fundamentally changed. And how do we let go of the fantasy of who we used to be? Not the fantasy, but the story of who we used to be.
Sure.
and be willing to explore what is different.
Well, that's really the process of grief. The process of grief is looking at what was and grieving that it has changed, saying goodbye to that part of our lives. It's not erased, but it has changed radically. And then when we're ready, attaching to what is. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that is sort of a limbo where we're actively grieving. It's very uncomfortable. And we keep wanting to reattach to what was.
Yes.
And
the hope that if we wish hard enough or dream hard enough, we can recreate.
You bet. Mm-hmm. And sitting with someone who is actively grieving and newly grieving is giving them all the time in the world to explore what was, talk about what was, grieve what was. Mm-hmm. And they have to do that. You have to say goodbye to that before you can really attach to your new reality.
I think that's what makes part of grief so painful, is you don't want to let go of the dream Mm-mm. of what was, because Mm-hmm. you have a whole life, Mm-hmm. like for Eric at two, Mm-hmm. you and your husband had a whole life already envisioned
Sure.
of who he would be.
Right.
And to let that go
is so painful. And people aren't really in a hurry for you to do that.
Yes, they are.
They want you
yes,
to do that really quickly.
Come back to be joyful.
Right,
yes.
Right. I mean, honestly, the first year after the death of a child is about putting one foot in front of the other, honestly. Mm-hmm. And at that point, people are getting worried about you if you aren't back to some semblance of what they think should be normal. And I had one mom say to me, my friends want me back. What does that mean? I'm not me anymore. I'll come back, but it won't be who they think I was before. Mm-hmm. And that is always a theme too, is I've changed and everyone wants me to be who I was and I feel different.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if you have to recreate the whole story that you're living Mm-hmm. and not just letting go of the person. And it's also challenging because we're not letting go of the person, but we're transforming how we relate
exactly.
it to that person.
Yes.
And I think people get stuck not wanting to let Mm-hmm. go because they think they have to stop thinking or feeling about.
Really, the as we move through and as we're going through the grieving process, one of the final tasks of grieving is really to find a way to honor the life of the person who died Mm-hmm. while attaching to a life without them. Mm-hmm. So you do get to bring them with you, but it's a different relationship, right? Because relationships depend on two people interacting. So you don't stop loving that person, but that love isn't the act of love that it was before. The
it's
relationship,
not caregiving,
right,
or, right,
right, it's changed.
So, how have you changed from the 30-year-old Claire?
Oh my gosh, so much, so much. I mean, the work that I ended up doing was the greatest gift that I could have ever had. I learned so much about myself. I was privileged to sit with people and have them share their hearts with me. I was inspired every day by the courage that it took for people to come in and share their hearts with me. So I am a deeper person. I'm a more compassionate person. I'm a more empathic person. I hope a kinder person. And part of how I honor Eric, he was the gentlest little sweetheart. And I decided a long time ago that if I could infuse gentleness into my work and my relationships, that that would be how I would bring him with me and honor him. So if I've ever described as gentle, I take that as a sort of that confirmation that I'm keeping that promise. Yeah.
And how did your relationship with your husband change throughout all of this?
You know, I think I mentioned I was very, very fortunate to have someone that we were able to talk. We were able to immediately, we were cautioned early on at Stanford, be careful of your relationship, because we see double tragedies here. We see the death of a child, we see the death of a marriage, and we were so determined that not happen to us. So we just have always been committed to sharing with one another. We did grieve in a different way. He's a different person than I am. And we allowed each other that. We said early on, we don't have to keep apologizing to each other. And we allowed each other to do what we needed to do. And he wasn't someone that was going to tell the story and be out there. But he absolutely, completely supported me in doing it. And, you know, communicate, you know, you just keep working together. And he knows, and I know what he went through, he knows what I went through, and that's a bond we have that's really unshakable.
So for someone who has someone they care about who's experiencing a loss and grief, what's the best way they can engage? Because it seems that that's the most important thing that grieving people
with
need.
With each other, you mean?
Just in general, if you know someone who's grieving, I think a lot of people are frozen and they don't know what to do, so they throw out a cliche or they throw out a card. But what's the most helpful thing someone can do for someone who's grieving?
Well, I think show up, first of all.
Don't ask, just show up.
Try not to be afraid of their grief. Remember that it's not about anything you're going to say. It's about you being present and being able to just let them know, I'm here for you.
And you won't catch it.
That's right. you won't catch it. And you being able to be with someone and sort of looking around. And sometimes some people, they're not geared to sitting in that space with someone sharing their grief. But maybe they are geared towards coming in and saying, how about if I take the kids out for an ice cream and give you a little time? Would that work for you? Or coming in, and especially in the initial stages of looking for things to do, don't ask, well, let me know if you need something.
Right, because no one's going to reach out
and
say,
no, and they can't possibly think about what they need. Mm. So, you know, screw up your courage, walk in and sit and know that your presence, loving presence, non-judgmental presence will mean the world.
Don't try to fix them. Don't try to make them feel better.
Right. And there isn't a magic phrase. I wish there was. Right. I would have shared it a long time ago.
Absolutely.
There isn't. But you can say to someone, I don't know what to say, but I can see that this is so painful and I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Huge.
Yes. I think for me, the big takeaway is always show up. Mm-hmm. Show up.
And I was just going to say, I asked a lot of my grieving parents when I was writing this book, what shall I say in the helper part? And they said, tell them to show up and tell them not to say dumb things.
Claire Agard, thank you so much for spending the hour with me. It went too quickly. Claire's book is called When a Child Dies, A Hopeful Healing Guide for Surviving the Loss of a Child. Good reading for parents with loss, but also might be a nice gift to share with someone who is struggling themselves. And I'm sure it's available through Amazon or wherever you find your books.
It is.
This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can reach me through email, elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, on Facebook, on Instagram, listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And as always, thank you for being part of our community and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Whenever you stumble, whenever your problems overload, whenever you worry, know that your heart don't beat alone, and I will be waiting with a hand to hold on to.
starlight, waiting to guide you home. And like a candle holds the light, I will hold you through the night. I remain, 'cause nobody cries alone.
Whenever you tremble, whenever your voice can't find the words, whatever your trouble, know that your heart don't beat alone. And I will be waiting from today to 99, through the darkness